Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the shootout in Oregon between Oregon State Troopers and the ragtag militia who call themselves Citizens for Constitutional Freedom that resulted in the death of the group's spokesperson, Robert Lavoie Finicum, and the arrest of the Bundy Boys, who have led the month-long occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in Burns, Oregon. Mark Potok, the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project and the editor of SPLC's Hate Watch blog, joins us to discuss the collective delusion that this armed militia operated on, that the United States government was oppressing them, and to quote the militia's deceased spokesperson, who left behind 11 foster children, "There are things more important than your life, and freedom is one of them." Then we'll try to figure out Donald Trump's strategy in boycotting the final Republican presidential debate on Fox News before Monday's Iowa caucus, based on Trump's hurt feelings over a Fox News memo joking about Trump and Putin and the presence of Megyn Kelly as a moderator for Thursday night's debate. Dr. Kerwin Swint, a professor of politics at Kennesaw State University, who specializes in campaigns, elections, and mass media, and is the author of Dark Genius, the influential career of legendary political operative and Fox News founder Roger Ailes, joins us to discuss the depressing irony that Fox News, the Pravda of the Republican Party, is now standing up for journalistic standards. Then finally, with yesterday's announcement by the South Coast Air Quality Management District that it is suing the Southern California Gas Company for negligence over the massive methane leak at Porter Ranch, demanding they permanently shut down the well that has been spewing out gas since October the 23rd, forcing thousands of residents from their homes, we are joined by Rob Jackson. He is a professor and senior fellow at the Woods Institute for the Environment and at the Precourt Institute and heads up the Jackson Lab at Stanford University. We'll discuss what went wrong with the well and why the leaking gas cannot be flared or captured. And joining us now is Mark Potok, who's the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project and editor of its award-winning quarterly investigative journal, Intelligence Report. In addition to editing the magazine and the Hate Watch blog, Potok acts as a key spokesman for the Southern Poverty Law Center, a well-known civil rights organization based in Alabama. He has testified before the Senate, the United Nations High Commission on Human Rights, and other venues. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Potok.
Thanks so much for having me.
And finally, there's been a resolution at this month-long militant occupation of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in Oregon, but it's not come without human cost. Killed was Robert Lavoie Finicum, who has been acting as a spokesman for the militants. And, of course, the Bundy boys were arrested along with a number of their followers. Do you think that Ayman Bundy has any concept of how much he bears responsibility for the death of his colleague?
He doesn't seem to. He seems to live in a fantasy world in which stealing from the federal government and the rest of the American people is somehow defending the Constitution. I mean, look, I think that not only Ayman Bundy, but the whole crew seem quite unhinged. The person, Lavoie Finicum, who was killed, had talked about wanting to be killed, about wanting to be a martyr. He was not going to leave no matter what. So in a way, it seems like these people put themselves in a corner and simply made it impossible to get out without some kind of violence.
But Finicum leaves behind 11 foster children. That's the part of it that's hard to understand. Why would you put your life in danger over something that's imminent? First of all, for the life of me, Mark Potok, I cannot understand how these people think that America is the land of the oppressed, particularly white people. They're not oppressed in this country. This is a very free country compared to 99% of the other countries in the world. So does that puzzle you? I know you work on this. Have you ever been able to figure out what motivates this peculiar delusion?
Well, I think it has something to do with our country's history and, you know, the whole idea of the frontier and guns and this sort of liberty that was unlike the liberty known to our European, you know, compatriots across the water and so on. And it's morphed into a kind of Frankenstein monster in which perfectly normal activities carried out by the federal government are somehow seen as oppression, you know, sort of fascist oppression. You know, I mean, these guys, you know, are concerned about things like the fact that the federal government charges them money to graze their cattle on federal lands. Well, you know, the reality is that ranchers who do graze their cattle on federal lands get an incredibly subsidized rate. They are paying something like 17% of the market rate of what grazing fees actually go for in the open market. So they're being given a deal to begin with, and yet they are whining and crying that the federal government is somehow overreaching. You know, and this is one of the things that Ammon Bundy has said repeatedly, the government's overreaching, they're stealing our lands here. And, of course, the reality is those lands have been federal lands for more than 100 years, since the time of Teddy Roosevelt, who created the National Park System. So their beef is not with Barack Obama, apparently it's with Teddy Roosevelt.
So, Mark Potok, do you think that there will be, in other words, will the feds throw the book at this guy? Because they've been incredibly patient. Look, if a group of Black Lives Matter or the Occupy movement, if they came armed with assault rifles and took over a federal building anywhere in this country, I think there'd be a very strong reaction. And it does seem to me that they've been, up until now, they've been treated with pretty much with kid gloves.
I think that's true. You know, I don't have any inside knowledge at all, but I would think that they're expecting at this point to more or less throw the book at them. The federal government and law enforcement in general has swallowed an incredible amount up to this point. You know, after all, let's not forget that many of these same people, including the two Bundy sons, Ammon and Ryan Bundy, engaged in another completely illegal standoff in 2014 in Nevada at the Bundy, to Cliven Bundy's ranch. You know, at that time, a number of them were pointing semi-automatic weapons at law enforcement officials, which is a very serious felony. And yet no one has been arrested or in any way harassed by the government or other authorities who was at that standoff almost 2 years ago. So I think at this point, everyone's patience has worn extremely thin. You know, I noticed that the governor of Oregon, along with the Oregonian newspaper editorially, has really been calling for some action. I think people up there are sick to death of it. I don't think it's true that these people have gotten much sympathy, certainly not in the area of Burns, Oregon, where this occupation has happened. I think local people generally see them as scam artists, people who are trying to get something for nothing, as opposed to great defenders of sort of truth, justice, and the American way.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Potok, who's the director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project and editor of its award-winning quarterly investigative journal, Intelligence Report. In addition to editing the magazine and the Hate Watch blog, Potok acts as a key spokesman for the Southern Poverty Law Center, a well-known civil rights organization based in Alabama. He has testified before the Senate, the United Nations High Commission on Human Rights, and other venues. When you talk about these people, you know, basically being mooches, it's worth noting that the father of these two Bundy boys, who were just arrested today by the FBI in a shootout that cost the life of one of their cohorts, Robert Lavoie Finicum, who was their spokesman. The father still hasn't paid the, I think he owes the feds, what, $1 or $2 million in back?
Yeah, he owes something like $1.2 million. That is 20 years of accumulated federal grazing fees. As I said earlier, these fees are really very minor. But Cliven Bundy has refused to pay them. And in fact, the government was incredibly patient with him. They did not move to seize his cattle for almost literally decades. Ultimately, after many, many years in court fighting this guy, they got a court order to seize Bundy's cattle. And we all know how that ends. Bundy and his militiamen friends basically ran off the feds at gunpoint. So, yes, I mean, Cliven Bundy, in a sense, started all of this, and he, above all, is really a thief, a person who has stolen over $1 million from us, from you and I, from the American people.
Well, this Robert Lavoie Finicum, the spokesman, had he been on your radar? Because it seemed like he had a death wish. He basically, in an interview that he did with NBC recently, he said that he was willing to die rather than be arrested, and cautioned authorities against pointing a gun at him. Quoting Finucane, "I have no intention of spending any of my days in a concrete box. There are things more important than your life, and freedom is one of them." So he paid for his beliefs, I guess, with his life. But over what? I mean, you know, it's just that's the part that's so incomprehensible.
I mean, over nothing. He gained absolutely nothing. He probably created a situation in which law enforcement's going to come down more heavily on his friends than they would have after had there not been shots fired. So it's really quite something to see. No, we had not known Finucane particularly before. I mean, he was a minor character in the original Bundy standoff in Bunkerville, Nevada. But he, as you noted, he came to be essentially their spokesman, the spokesman for the group this time, and made quite a lot of those kinds of fiery and threatening comments.
So the fact of the matter, though, is from what I understand, that this was not the FBI. They were there at the scene. And this convoy of the Bundy boys and Finucane and a few of their militia followers, they were heading to a speaking engagement, I understand, and they were pulled over by the Oregon State Troopers. It was the Oregon State Troopers that engaged them in a gunfight, and we're not entirely sure about the details of that at this point. But, you know, we've had a lot of police shootings in this country, many of them people have been shocked by, and some of them appear to be totally unprovoked and completely unacceptable. However, you or I, if we get pulled over by a state trooper, we're not going to brandish assault rifles at them, are we? I mean, that sounds like what happened.
Yeah, it does. I mean, as for I don't know for sure who was involved in the shootout with these guys, although definitely some local law enforcement was. I think to the extent that the FBI has held back, tried to stay a little less visible, at least until yesterday, they have been doing so because they are so reviled as federal law enforcement by the people in this movement, the militia movement, the so-called Patriot Movement. So that has probably been wise. The Bundy brothers and a number of other people who have been occupiers up there subscribe essentially to an ideology which says the county sheriff is the highest form of legitimate law enforcement in the United States, an idea that emanates from very radical and racist and anti-Semitic groups of the 1970s. So on that basis, I think the FBI was probably wise to keep a relatively low profile.
But are they? Do you think they're restrained by what happened at Ruby Ridge and Waco? Is that mythology certainly spawned a lot, didn't it, in the militia movement?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it's you know, they're not constrained legally, but I think it is very much in their minds. It's worth remembering that only a couple of hours' drive from where all this happened in Burns, Oregon, was the venue or the site of a very serious standoff between the so-called Montana Freemen and the FBI in 1996. And the Freeman standoff lasted some 81 days, longer than any standoff in memory. And yet, at the end, all of the Montana Freemen, more than 20 of them, came out and surrendered without gaining anything. They got none of their demands, of course, and they all went off to ultimately to prison. So that was a great lesson. The FBI was able, by using a great deal of patience, to simply sit these people out. Here we've been in a somewhat different situation. I mean, while it's well advised not to go rushing in, guns blazing, if one doesn't have to, in this situation, it's the continuation of what began in 2014 at the Bundy Ranch. In other words, the fact that the government backed off during the showdown at the Bundy Ranch in 2014 has essentially emboldened these other groups to do very similar actions. So in a sense, the government was between a rock and a hard place here. They were getting a lot of pressure, and pretty reasonable pressure, from local residents up there, from the newspapers, from the governor of Oregon, to do something to end this situation. And at the same time, they were very concerned not to create martyrs in another Waco. You know, we'll see if Finucane becomes a martyr It's a bit hard to believe, because the more one knows about that standoff or that occupation in Oregon, the more one realizes what an incredibly dysfunctional bunch of people this was. You know, some of them have been arrested for things like stealing cars. One of them has a former murder conviction. You know, they've gotten into a couple of fist fights as they argue among themselves. You know, one of them fled with his tail between his legs when it was revealed by a British paper that he was not, in fact, the combat-tested Marine veteran of Afghanistan and Iraq that he claimed to be. In fact, he'd never seen combat at all. So, you know, we'll see how it plays out, how the rest of the radical right really winds up viewing these people, but they are not a very appealing bunch.
So just in the last couple of minutes then, Mark Potok, it's pretty clear that the local people were frustrated with them and they wanted, and even the two guys that went to jail, who were the original sort of cause that these militia guys took up, they distanced themselves and they turned themselves into Terminal Island here in Los Angeles, federal prison. So they didn't even want to – they distanced themselves. The local and law enforcement were frustrated and angry at these people. The local people were angry with them. But while a lot of the local ranchers apparently disagreed with these protesters' tactics, some of them shared their frustrations about how the federal government controls all this land in the West. So what's going on here? Do these people want the government to give them the land? I mean, you've already made it clear how cheap
that is. There's a long history, you know, 30, 40, 50-year history of essentially kind of struggles between local ranchers and local residents and the big federal agencies that control this land, principally the Bureau of Land Management, but also outfits like the U.S. Department of Fisheries and so on. And, you know, some of these issues are legitimate. I think there's been a lot of back and forth between those two groups. But I think that when you listen to what locals around Burns have been saying for the last few weeks since this occupation began, essentially what it boils down to is, yes, we've had many difficulties with the federal government being tone deaf, not working well with local people and so on. But those difficulties have been very largely resolved. Things have gotten much, much better, according to them, in the last 10 or 15 years. So, and I think that's true generally across the West, that there's been a lot of progress made on these kinds of issues that do divide local residents, especially people who work in agriculture and the government. You know, the problem, if there is an objective problem that could somehow remotely justify what the Bundys did, is a diminishing one.
Well, Mark Potok, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
A real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Mark Potok, who's director of the Southern Poverty Law Center's Intelligence Project and editor of its award-winning quarterly investigative journal, Intelligence Report. In addition to editing the magazine and the Hate Watch blog, Potok acts as a key spokesman for the Southern Poverty Law Center, a well-known civil rights organization based in Alabama. He has testified before the Senate, the United Nations High Commission on Human Rights, and in other venues. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back trying to figure out Donald Trump's strategy in boycotting Thursday night's Republican presidential debate.
There's room at the top, they are telling you still. But first you must learn how to smile when you kill. If you want to be like the folks on the hill.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dr. Kerwin Swint, an author, speaker, and professor of politics at Kennesaw State University in Atlanta, specializing in campaigns and elections and mass media. He's the author of Dark Genius, the influential career of legendary political operative and Fox News founder Roger Ailes. And his latest book is The King Whisperers, Power Behind the Throne, From Rasputin to Rove. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Kerwin Swint.
Thank you, Ian. Glad to be here.
And clearly, Roger Ailes has been feeling the heat from Donald Trump, actually going back to the first debate where Trump and Megyn Kelly, the Fox News host, clashed. And back then, of course, I think Trump won that first round, didn't he? He sort of boycotted Fox until he got an apology from Roger Ailes and was always on CNN, MSNBC, and Fox. First of all, their listeners, a lot of their viewers support Trump. That was one factor. And the other factor was that they were losing ratings because the other people were getting Trump because he, for better or for worse, he seems to be a magnet for attention. How do you rate this second round in terms of Donald Trump boycotting Thursday's final debate with the Republican presidential candidates before the Iowa caucuses?
Well, it's a kind of a bizarre situation, Ian. I mean, Trump continues to defy expectations and run a campaign like no one has ever seen someone run a presidential campaign before. And, you know, he's facing, in this case, Roger Ailes, another titan of the media world and the political world, and someone else used to getting his way and winning. And so it's an interesting face-off. And in this second round, I mean, you would think that Trump would want to be at the final debate before the all-important Iowa caucus. But the fact that he is not going to be there, I can only attribute to his calculation that he's ahead, that they feel good about their chances of at least winning on Monday in Iowa, if not winning decisively. And so he doesn't want to take a chance on that being reversed and has calculated that, hey, he's going to stay away.
But don't you think he's giving an open invitation to the rest of the candidates, particularly Cruz? His numbers in Iowa have gone down. At Trump, I think, has been very clever in the way that he has eclipsed Cruz's lead by reaching out to Jerry Falwell and Sarah Palin, getting her endorsement, Sheriff Joe Arpaio. He's obviously a very clever guy. But at the same time, this seems like a very dangerous, if not boneheaded move because, you know, the other guys on stage, I guarantee you, they're all going to basically paint him as a coward and he couldn't face up to Megyn Kelly, who'll be there, you know, smiling glamorously.
It's definitely a gamble. I mean, but, you know, if you look at the last week to 10 days, all the momentum has been on Trump's side. You mentioned the endorsements. The polls have been going up. I think that they believe they're in a commanding position. And, you know, the thing about this Roger Ailes dust-up is, you know, Roger Ailes, he thinks like a political consultant more than he thinks really like a broadcaster. And he always operates that way. And that snarky statement Fox News put out, you know, about the Ayatollah and Putin, you know, going to hurt Donald's feelings, that gave Trump the excuse that he needed to say, well, I'm not going to go if they're going to treat me like this. This is unprofessional. You know, so in a way, if it works out in Trump's favor, it could be seen as a slip-up by Roger Ailes, you know, something that that didn't work. But you're right as far as what's going to happen at the debate without Trump. They're going to beat him up, and they're going to call him a coward. Whether that's going to be decisive or not, though, who knows? I mean, you know, time will tell whether this is a mistake by Trump or not. But it's definitely he's taken somewhat of a risk.
So I did see the press conference that he gave a couple of days ago where he went on about this press release that Fox put out making fun of him and the Ayatollah and Putin. And it wasn't I don't think it was particularly clever, but it certainly wasn't that provocative to get under his skin. But he clearly was using it as an excuse for his subsequent actions of boycotting. At that point during the press conference, he said he was thinking about it, but now apparently he's thought it through and he's going to go ahead and boycott. But the thing that I don't understand is the logic of what he keeps saying, and he kept repeating this in his press conference Why do I have to make Fox rich? Instead, of course, Trump says, I'm going to have a competing event in Iowa, and we're going to raise funds for the Wounded Warriors. And I'll be basically spending my time doing something more useful and noble than making Fox rich. And then he goes on to say that, you know, the ratings are going to tank now and it's going to be a disaster on Thursday because he's not on stage. So there's a fairly glaring contradiction there. He doesn't want to make them rich. On the other hand, his absence is going to tank them. What do you make of that?
I think those are distractions. I mean, I'm not sure his logic adds up when he says all of those things. I mean, the fact that it's going to make Fox News money, I mean, why does he care about that? I mean, so I think they've made a strategic calculation that they think is going to be in their favor, and he's justifying it by making all these, you know, leaps and bounds and in logic that may or may not add up.
Again, I'm speaking with Dr. Kerwin Swint, who's an author, speaker, and professor of politics at Kennesaw State University in Atlanta, specializing in campaigns and elections and mass media. He's the author of Dark Genius, The Influential Career of Legendary Political Operative and Fox News Founder Roger Ailes. And his latest book is The King Whisperer, Power Behind the Throne, From Rasputin to Rove. But the war is being escalated via Twitter, which seems to be Donald Trump's favorite venue. Now he's calling the Fox News anchor Megyn Kelly a bimbo in his tweets on Wednesday. I don't understand why he's doing this. Do you? Why is he going after this woman? She's quite popular, and she actually asked pretty good questions, at least in that first debate. But, you know, he made some really derogatory remarks about her in terms of menstruation, which was really, I think, really below the belt. But now he's calling her a bimbo. Is he out of control, or is there a strategy here? Because we've already established that he's very, very smart in his political calculus and how he's eclipsed Cruz in Iowa. But this doesn't appear to be very smart. This appears to be sort of boorish and petty.
Well, it seems like a lot of the things he's done don't appear to be very smart, but, you know, they work for him. He's such a unique individual, a unique candidate in politics. Going back to that first Fox debate when Megyn Kelly asked that question about the things he says about people, his response was, well, what I say is what I say. And I think that sort of encapsulates him as a person and as a candidate, is that, you know, he's all bluster. And, it's unprecedented that a presidential candidate has said the insulting things he says about practically everybody. The name calling, the bluster. I mean, it's something you wouldn't expect. But for him and his persona, you know, this sort of larger than life figure that he has set himself up to be, and a lot of people look at him as, it doesn't seem to hurt him like it would a normal candidate. It's just amazing.
Well, this tweet, by the way, is actually talk about a backhanded way to call somebody a bimbo. I'm quoting Trump's tweet. I refuse to call Megyn Kelly a bimbo because that would not be politically correct. Instead, I will only call her a lightweight reporter.
That's less classic Trump. He does seem to like Twitter an awful lot, I guess, because he can just spout off at will in these short little bursts. And, you know, if you listen to his press conferences, he sort of makes Twitter-like bursts, you know, when he says these things. You know, it's just 40 characters or less a lot of times.
Well, but this is really descending to a kind of schoolyard kind of name-calling, you know.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's like nothing I've ever seen in a presidential campaign, or even most state-level campaigns don't devolve to name-calling like that.
So do you think that our politics have descended? I mean, you know, arguably we've had kind of game show politics in any case, but now it seems to be like a reality show politics. When, you know, we have these discussions as though, you know, we can't believe this is happening to this illustrious political tradition that we have, being very sarcastic. But on the other hand, not only does it not hurt Trump, it seems to help him. So is this a referendum on the American electorate and the American people and you know, what's happened to us in terms of our education, our seriousness? You know, I mean, if you think about, go back to the Kennedy-Nixon debate, that was all about substance. I mean, Nixon apparently lost because of style, not substance. He looked like he had a 5 o'clock shadow, whereas Kennedy looked, fresh and boyish. But at least they were talking about serious stuff. Can you figure out what's happened to our polity?
Well, it just seems to get worse and worse, but it's never quite gone this far, this fast, when you're talking about political dialogue, even in debates, where we're used to candidates attacking each other and even sometimes being personal with each other, although you tend to see more of that in televised ads. With Donald Trump saying the things that he's saying and acting the way he's acting, we've gone awfully far, awfully fast, it seems to me, as far as the coarseness of the dialogue, the things that we're prepared to accept from a major political candidate, that are just unprecedented. And I don't know what it says about the culture or our expectations of candidates. Maybe it says something about social media, because I think there's a certain higher level of acceptance for this kind of behavior and this kind of brutality and name calling on things like Twitter, on platforms like that, that are less. Less conventional and less responsive to the traditional norms of what's acceptable.
Well, Trump's campaign guy, not that I think Trump's an unguided missile, I'm not sure his campaign manager has a lot of control over him, but he's now saying at the end of the day, Mr. Trump is going to have the last laugh. So, I mean, I think you're right in saying that they've made this calculus that it's better to boycott the last debate in the event that maybe something goes wrong, because he's on a roll and he's mm-hmm. leading. But you've got Governor Jeb Bush saying, poor little Donald being treated unfairly. I mean, I must say that I've never seen such venomous and outrageous put-downs of a candidate on a stage, where Donald Trump in the last debate basically scorned Bush and said, you're weak, Mm-hmm. Like a father calling a son a weakling. It was that kind of venomous and vicious. Did you find that extraordinary?
Yeah, I mean, he's completely dismissive of the other candidates when they challenge him, or to anyone that challenges him. I mean, it's amazing watching him with the media at that press conference last night. I mean, he argues with the reporters. He doesn't let them finish their questions. He challenges them. He calls them bad. He says, you're a bad reporter.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Again, that's something that I've never seen a major candidate do before. And if he does have the last laugh and he makes all this work in his favor, I think we'll be trying to explain this for decades. I mean,
well, but I think I was astounded by the way he harassed that reporter over the abortion quote and saying, give us the whole quote, and he kept berating them. He rates the questions. And so, he's not only not going to answer the questions, he turns it around to make it a referendum on whether it's a good question or a bad question.
That's right.
And whether you're a good reporter or a bad reporter.
But everything is a fight. It's all combat with
right,
it.
But I guarantee you, his supporters love it. There's nothing more they hate in America than what they call the mainstream media, or what Sarah Palin calls the lamestream media. That seems to be their favorite target. So that's not going to hurt him one bit with his supporters. At least that's my opinion.
No, I think you're right. Yeah, I mean, when you're running for the Republican nomination, it doesn't hurt at all to be fighting with the media. A lot of Republican primary voters will love that, absolutely.
So when you have Les Moonves, the head of CBS, crowing about how great this political year is because they're just going to make so much money, and obviously not taking any responsibility as an American citizen, being kind of ashamed at how low the political discourse has become. But what's your sense of how Roger Ailes sees things? I mean, he can't be unhappy about this turn of events in terms if he all he cares about is ratings. And you just said earlier that he's not really a head of a network. He's still a political operative and thinks like a political operative.
Yeah, that's the way he thinks. I mean, he's used to winning. He's used to being in control of situations. And I think, the feeling that he's not in control here is probably killing him. Right now, he's probably thinking of a way to get back in control and get back on top of the situation. I don't think they're going to hurt financially from this. I don't know what the ratings are going to be. I'm sure they're not going to be as big as they have been for some of the previous debates, but I don't know that it's really going to hurt their bottom line all that much. Not to be concerned about.
Well, there is a precedent, of course, for skipping debates in Iowa, and that was when Ronald Reagan opted out of debating George H.W. Bush before the Iowa caucuses in 1980. And apparently Reagan was punished by the Iowans. He lost that contest because he obviously won the nomination. So if history is any judge, this is a very risky calculus on Trump's part.
It's definitely a risk. I believe they think it's a risk we're taking, and it could be a stroke of brilliance. I mean, if he ends up winning the Iowa caucus and running away with the nomination, I mean, you know, this will be looked at as a master move. But yet, it does carry quite a bit of risk. And if he doesn't win, then there's going to be a lot of second guessing about it.
Well, just in closing, what's the calculus going on with Ailes, though? Because this, he's getting a lot of publicity. I'm sure they will. I don't think the ratings are going to be low at all. I think Trump is inadvertently, you know, drawn eyeballs to Thursday night's debate. And I think it's also probably helping Megyn Kelly. I mean, to tell you the truth, I cannot believe that in journalism we're down to the low point where Fox News is standing up for journalistic principles. I mean, isn't that depressing?
Well, it's funny is what it is. I mean, you know, and Fox News has been so closely associated with conservatism and the Republican Party, and they're used to candidates coming to them, political figures trying to come to them. I think Roger Ailes is stunned that, you know, this is happening. But yeah, Megyn Kelly is being defended by journalists around the country and Fox News, too, to a degree. So it's quite ironic, really.
But just to finish up, though, since so many we were talking earlier about how the Trump's supporters love him beating up on the lamestream media, as
yep.
Sarah Palin calls it, they're also most of them, I think all of them, would be Fox viewers. So is that the vice that Trump is putting Ailes in the sense that if you really alienate Trump supporters, you're going to lose Fox viewers?
Well, I think that they're both vying to be the top guy. They're both vying to be the one in control, the one that's the center of attention. And if Trump goes on to win the nomination, I think that for the fall campaign, he and Fox News are going to have to come together in some way. They're going to have to make amends. They're going to have to bridge the gap in some way. Or that could hurt Trump in the fall election. If Fox News viewers are being told, you know, that Trump is bad news and that he's not going to get it done for us. So I think they have to come to some agreement at some point.
Well, Dr. Cohen-Swindt, I thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Cohen-Swindt, who's an author, speaker, and professor of politics at Kennesaw State University in Atlanta, where he specializes in campaigns and elections and mass media. He's the author of Dark Genius, The Influential Career of Legendary Political Operative and Fox News Founder Roger Ailes. And his latest book is The King Whisperers, Power Behind the Throne, From Rasputin to Rove. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the announcement by the South Coast Air Quality Management District that it's suing the Southern California Gas Company for negligence, demanding they shut down the leaking well at Porter Ranch.
I can hold my head still with my hands at my knees. These eyes are the eyes of the old, shivering and bold. I will try not to breathe. This decision is mine. I have lived a full life. These are the eyes that I.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. Joining us now is Rob Jackson, a professor and senior fellow at the Woods Institute for the Environment and the Precourt Institute for Energy. He heads up the Jackson Lab at Stanford University, where he examines the different ways people affect the Earth and helps to provide knowledge to guide policy solutions for global warming, energy extraction, and other environmental issues. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rob Jackson.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And Rob, you've been looking into the Porter Ranch gas leak here in north of Los Angeles, which has been going on now for months, and is spewing enormous amounts of methane into the environment. And we all know how detrimental that is in terms of global warming. But just on Tuesday, the South Coast Air Quality Management District have sued the gas company and basically demanded that they shut down the well. So do you think the Southern California Gas Company will abide by this order, I guess it is, even though it's a suit?
Yeah, I don't know the details of the suit. I don't think the suit necessarily yet means one way or the other that this particular well will be closed. The bigger question is the field. So the storage field has about 115 wells in it. So to close this particular well really isn't that big of a decision. I'd be surprised if this particular well stayed open just because of the attention it's received. But the bigger question is what happens to the other 114 wells at Aliso Canyon.
But surely the main question is, how do you stop that gas spewing out of this particular well that's been going on now for months?
Yeah, it started in late October. The company tried multiple times to essentially provide back pressure to take clay and brines, dense solutions, and push that gas back down. But what happened is they pushed the gas down, but then the gas went down and around the protective casing on the outside of the well and is now traveling up through the rock to the surface. So in some sense, the problem is worse than it was to start with.
So in other words, this old pipe that I believe is about 50 or 60 years old, because this is an old oil depleted oil well from the 50s.
It is.
The gas is not coming, obviously it's coming up that pipe, and there's been a lot of attention paid to the fact that there used to be a safety valve and it was removed. But this situation now is worse, right? It's coming up around the outside of the pipe. And so that would mean at the top where you see those infrared pictures of the gas spewing out, that gas is not just spewing out of the pipe itself, but it's spewing out around the pipe in terms of fissures that have been created?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The original safety valve that was in place in the 1970s was deep. I think it was about 8,000 feet underground. The gas now isn't coming up through the steel tubing itself. It's coming up to the surface around the outside of that protective casing and cement. So that's one of the reasons that the leak is harder to seal off than it would be if it were coming through the tube itself. And obviously, the other thing that the company is doing is trying to drill a relief well. The relief well will be drilled about 8,500 feet down, and they're trying to intersect this old well and reroute the gas up the new tube. And if they can do that successfully, then they can shut this other one off. But it's taking a couple of months to do that, and we won't know whether that works until the end of February or the first half of March.
And again, I'm speaking with Rob Jackson, a professor and senior fellow at the Woods Institute for the Environment and at the Precourt Institute for Energy. He heads up the Jackson Lab at Stanford University, which examines the different ways people affect the Earth and helps to provide knowledge to guide policy solutions for global warming, energy extraction, and other environmental issues. So the fact that this gas is flowing around the pipe at the top there, which we've all seen the infrared pictures, that means that you can't flare this gas off, right? Because you just simply don't know where it's all coming from. What would be the footprint of the area where this gas is spewing up?
A great question. I don't know the answer to that question. The distant shots with infrared cameras of the dark plume don't really tell you how far away from the wellhead the emissions are happening. So I don't know that. It does pose a problem, though, for flaring. An obvious solution would be to capture this gas and burn it. We do that in Los Angeles at refineries and other locations, and we do it in oil and gas fields all over the country and around the world. In this particular case, though, the volume of air is really large. That's the first problem. And the second issue is what you referred to, Ian, the fact that it's not coming out in one discrete place. So you have to have some kind of giant tube or, you know, some kind of bag-like structure that covers a reasonably large area and reroutes that gas to a burner that you could then light. So it's possible, but it's also dangerous to get that process started.
And what explains, then, the slow reaction? Was this to do with negligence, a cover-up, or just the fact that they didn't really have a handle on it? And apparently their initial response to pump down the brine and clay actually made it worse. So what do you think this, the sequence of events there was and the culpability that this company may have, given that the South Coast Air Quality Management are suing them?
Yeah, I think negligence is a legal term, and I'm not the right person to use a term like that. The company tried, as I mentioned, to seal the leak back off. It didn't work. That doesn't mean that they're negligent in trying that. It means that the process simply didn't work. You know, were there additional things they might have done? Are there things that they could have done more quickly, particularly in the relationship of the leak to the surrounding Porter Ranch neighborhood? Absolutely. But in terms of negligence and such, I have no idea.
Well, specifically in the lawsuit, the South Coast Air Quality Management District are saying that the company's negligence led to injuries that have created an ongoing public nuisance and has caused significant harm to animals, plants, and people around the globe. I guess that's referring to the effects of methane in terms of it being such a virulent global warming gas. So that's where we stand. But how many other wells are there just in this one district around here in Porter Ranch?
This field, I believe, has 115 or so injection wells on it. It's an old oil and gas field, of course. Most of the 420 or so natural gas storage fields around the U.S. are old oil and gas fields where that gas or oil was pumped out of the ground, leaving behind a bunch of open or vacant space. And the notion behind these fields is that if they held natural gas for millions of years, they'd hold gas for 6 months or a year for this temporary storage application. And that's a reasonable proposition unless you have a problem with the injection wells themselves, which is what we have at Aliso Canyon.
Right, but it sounds like this was an accident waiting to happen if these wells are 50, 60 years old.
Well, it's true. It's an older well. There are a lot of, you know, older wells and older pipelines in this country. The age in and of itself doesn't mean that there's a problem. Obviously, aging infrastructure, whether it be natural gas infrastructure or bridges and roads or water mains, on average tend to have more problems. But I think the bigger question is, how common are the safety valves? How common is it to have a blowout preventer on wells like these? Is it common across these storage fields, or is it uncommon? Why wasn't the safety cutoff valve replaced in the 1970s when it was taken out? Those kinds of questions we don't know. We also don't know what the maintenance record for this particular well was and for the other wells across this field. Were there earlier problems at this SS-25 well where the leak is happening? Or was its safety record quite good? I don't know the answers to those questions.
But the one question that surely has to be answered is, how did this happen in the first place? What was the failure that created this massive gas leak?
Yeah, I'm not sure anybody knows that. The question of what started it is an interesting one. There's been speculation that a small earthquake might have started it. Some kind of shear, for example, on the well could have started it. Or it could have been something mechanical. I have not seen any explanation of what triggered this initially.
Well, I'm trying to picture this as a layperson, that you have these old oil wells, and then you have all this natural gas that you need to store, and clearly they don't want to have to store them in big steel tanks that we see. That's just not practical given the amount. So they pump this stuff down through the pipes that go down into the old oil wells that are depleted, and they pump it down. And so if you have a mechanism that can push it down under pressure to store it, and then you must have, of course, a mechanism that allows it to be released and put into the natural gas grid. That's where the failure must have been, at that sort of locus point, right?
Yeah.
That's right.
I mean, the storage fields are like, they're not like a cave or an open cavern like Carlsbad Caverns that you would walk through. You can think of it more as a honeycomb of open pore space. The integrity of the formation, the geology, hasn't been compromised in any way. As I said, it held natural gas or oil for millions of years. That means that it's pretty tight. But the injection wells, the old oil and gas wells, puncture those geologic formations. And that's why well integrity, the cement that's used, the steel casing that's used, and the monitoring and testing of those wells are all the keys to safety in an operation like this. It's all about the well itself, how well that well was maintained, you know, what the safety record is, or what testing was done on it.
Well, then you have to multiply that by the number of wells, right?
You do. You do.
And this is one of, what was the number again?
About 115 out at Aliso Canyon in this particular field, and there are 415 or 20 of these kinds of fields around the U.S. Aliso Canyon's one of the top five biggest in the country, but there are lots of others.
So the rough math on that is about, what, 40,000 wells?
If each field had 100 or so wells in it, I don't know if that's the case.
But
Aliso Canyon, interestingly, is the fifth biggest natural gas storage field in the United States. This is a big operation. And if you wanted to spring a leak in a natural gas storage field, this is not the field that you would pick for that. Even ignoring the proximity to people in Los Angeles, it's a big field.
So what's in this gas that's got the local people so upset, and they've felt the effects, the health effects, they've smelt it, they've got nausea, they've got headaches, they complained and complained, and then eventually the authorities started to take them seriously. I mean, I don't sense that the gas company from day one was prepared or anxious to let the public know about what was happening. It, as far as I can tell, we only learned about it because the local residents were up in arms because they were having health effects. So, and then they've already moved. They've been relocated. The schools have been closed, et cetera. And so what are the health effects in the sense that what is this stuff that they're breathing?
Yeah. Well, 99% of this gas is methane, ethane, and propane. These are propane that you run your grill on, methane that you use to light your stove and cook your food or heat your home. These gases are not, in terms of breathing, dangerous unless they're at very, very high concentrations. And they're not at nearly dangerous concentrations when you move a mile away to a nearby neighborhood. So health-wise, they're not the issue. There are two groups of compounds that are the issue. The first group is the odorants, the sulfur gases, the rotten egg-smelling gases that are put into the natural gas so that we can smell it. Methane doesn't have an odor. These are compounds that cause the irritation, problems with people's throats and such. They are very, very active in people. We can smell them at very low part per billion ranges. That's why they're used in this situation. The bigger health concern, though, isn't the sulfur compounds. It's the trace gases like benzene and toluene and xylene. Benzene is a carcinogen. Toluene and xylene are neurologically active gases. They're not things you want to be breathing. Let's just look at benzene. It's a heavier molecular weight hydrocarbon, and it's a very small percentage, less than 1 in 1,000 molecules in natural gas. But it's also a gas that if you breathe, we regulate down at parts per billion because of its activity as a carcinogen. So benzene, more than anything else, is the gas that has people in the neighborhood most concerned.
So your lab, Rob Jackson, the Jackson Lab at Stanford University, recently published the first studies looking at fracking and drinking water quality and mapped thousands of natural gas leaks across the United States. I'm under the impression that there really isn't. I mean, let's just look at the broad energy picture here, that natural gas has been a big boon and it's rapidly replacing coal. And if you watch television, the natural gas industry and the oil and gas industry advertise furiously telling us how wonderful it all is and how much cleaner it is. But given that if there's a leakage of methane, that offsets the value to global warming of replacing coal. That's logical, right?
So, yeah, of course, it is. It just depends on how much it leaks, right?
Right, but my question is there a real inventory from the well to the home of where these natural gas leaks? Because I just had the gas company come to our home the other day because there was a gas leak, and they very promptly fixed it. But you smell gas all over the place. So do we know how much methane is leaking into the atmosphere on a daily basis here just in the United States?
Depends. We do, in a reasonable sense. There's been a lot of work done on this in the last 5 years. My group's worked on it. Lots of other groups have, too. And I would summarize it as saying that all these studies suggest that the estimates from the Environmental Protection Agency and from state agencies are too low. for leakage. So whether you look upstream at well pads or downstream, as we've done across city streets in cities, the leakage rates are higher than what the inventories suggest. It's not as if 50% of the gas is leaking out, though. The question really is how much, and the more interesting question to me is what can we do about it? How can we use information to reduce these leaks as they happen and to improve the environmental footprint of natural gas? Because part of the question is what you compare natural gas to. In my view, if you take an old coal plant offline and replace it with a natural gas plant, that's certainly better. That's an improvement over the old coal plant. It's not as good from an environmental standpoint as replacing that coal plant with a wind turbine or solar PV, but we have a distributed and diverse source of energy across this country. So my interest is in trying to take something like natural gas and figure out why it leaks, where it leaks, and how it leaks, and reduce them.
Well, that I think is well. Let me ask you this: are we on top of that? Are the companies that are clearly making a lot of money now because natural gas is all the rage, and the U.S. has created energy independence? I believe it's the biggest natural gas producer in the world now, the United States. So, if people are making money out of this or this fracking boon, are they equally paying attention to the downside, which is the leakage of methane?
Well, of course, the issue right now for the past year is that nobody's making any money.
That's true, because of the Saudis, right?
Well, the oil prices and the gas prices are down in the dumps. I mean, oil is sort of 10 or 15 year low. Natural gas is way back to almost record lows again. So, I mean, one of the problems when oil and gas prices are really low is having the money to pay attention to environmental stewardship when you're laying people off at the same time. It's actually a more difficult climate to address leakage and environmental concerns when everybody's losing money and laying people off than it is during boom times.
So just in closing then, Rob Jackson, is there any government entity, any policeman out there that's going around measuring the methane and telling them to plug the leaks?
There are inspectors in each state. The oil and gas industry in the U.S. is regulated almost exclusively at the level of the state, the California level, the Texas level, the Pennsylvania, North Dakota level. Each state has an agency. That agency is charged with keeping track of these sorts of things. The inventories that are done by the states are not very good, to be honest. That's one reason why there's so much research done in academia trying to understand what the actual leakage rates are. We could do a lot better. Companies are and have invested in reducing these leaks. The leaks are lost income, lost revenue for those companies. So I would say there are companies that have really done quite a lot, states that have done a lot, like Colorado has passed good air quality regulations in the last year or two. There are also companies and states that haven't done very much, and we have to nudge those along.
Well, Rob Jackson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Rob Jackson, who's a professor and senior fellow at the Woods Institute for the Environment and at the Precourt Institute for Energy. He heads up the Jackson Lab at Stanford University, which examines the different ways people affect the Earth and helps to provide knowledge to guide policy solutions for global warming, energy extraction, and other environmental issues. The Jackson Lab recently published the first studies looking at fracking and drinking water quality and mapped thousands of natural gas leaks across the United States. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.